So, we have Colleen McCabe here, who's going to talk about her experience at UW-Madison and her experience with academic staff governance. So, if I remember correctly from what we talked about before, UW-Madison has been your home forever. Your father was employed here, is that right?
True.
So, tell me more about that. You grew up here?
Yes, I was. My dad was in graduate school, and my mother was working at the chemistry department here part-time when I was born. So they lived at 217 North Orchard Street, which is now the site of the computer science building.
Oh.
And when I was working at DeWitt, or when it was Mac then, I saw the building come down. And actually, when I started working on campus at the computing center, my parking space was where my sandbox was when I was little. So anyway, we lived in the apartment building at 217 North Orchard. And one of my earliest memories there was when some of the monkeys escaped from Harlow's primate lab, which was similar to where it is now. One of the monkeys was in the tree right outside the apartment, and my mother tried to lure it over with a banana, but it didn't come over. But anyway, it was, I can remember seeing this right. Escaped monkey out of the tree right by the railroad tracks.
Did they gather the monkeys back?
They did get them all back eventually. Yeah. I don't think any of them were harmed, but it was a funny day.
Yeah, right. Now, you said your father was at the graduate school?
Yes, he was in graduate school. He was one of Aldo Leopold's students.
Okay.
And the Aldo Leopold's office was in a white frame building that is now, I think it's Babcock Hall,
okay.
Or some building over there. So my dad had an office there, and Aldo Leopold had an office there, and we were involved in many ways with the Leopolds. I was pretty young then, but I remember going on picnics with the Leopold family out at the shack.
Oh my.
When I was
small.
Also, my dad was involved in experiments, or I guess experiments is a word, out at the Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
And it was still kind of configured like you would see pictures of it post-World War II, because, of course, that's when this was, in the late 40s. And I would remember playing in the dirt, digging in the dirt and finding lenses. I don't know exactly what they were lenses of, but there were lots of them there, these concave pieces of glass.
Yeah.
And there's, I think, partly the reason I remember it is because there's some pictures of me sitting in the dirt, digging around with these pieces of equipment that I guess were stored there. As some war equipment was stored there, I guess. Then. So those are the early years. Then
may I just ask?
Sure.
So your father went to graduate school,
right?
And finished up, and then.
Then he was hired.
Then he was hired
as a faculty member in the department.
Okay. And your mother was in chemistry,
right?
On the faculty?
No.
No.
She was just a secretary.
Okay.
And then when I was born, and then I had two brothers. She didn't work anymore.
Okay.
And then my parents had a chance to move to university houses, which were just built.
Mm-hmm.
And these were, I don't know if it's still called university houses. They're not the Eagle Heights red brick ones, but the white ones that are up the hill. And they were brand new, and they were for faculty in those days.
Yeah.
So there were many young faculty members who moved in there, and many of my parents' friends went on to be high administrators on campus, like Bob Bach and Bob Clodius and Ralph Curl and Hank Lardy, and names you might not know, but these were people who were prime movers in the campus. And they, when they started out, they lived there and had little kids, and it was a great place to be a kid because there were so many other kids, and it was very much a community. And there was, we lived on a corner unit. I think there were 4 or 6 units, and right by the woods. So we could play in the woods. If we went on a little further, we could play in the university farms. We had a community garden, and we went to Shorewood School. Mm-hmm. So I also did, starting maybe even before we moved, I went to university preschool.
Uh-huh.
So
so your life totally
is, yes, so it's a very beginning, continuing on. And then, so friends that, some of my friends from grade school in Shorewood kids also went to, were in the preschool. And so the Shorewood kids who were in my class and were my friends were really big people in the community, like the Fitzpatricks from Fitzpatrick Lumber and Marling from Marling Lumber. And so it was just a nice group of people, a nice time to be a kid. And it was fun to go and stay overnight at their big fancy houses, mm-hmm, instead of my university houses, that big bedroom I shared with 2 brothers.
Right.
So anyway, I went to Shorewood School from kindergarten through 4th grade, and then my parents built a house on the west side, which was at the edge of town. At that time, it was off Seagull Road, and mm-hmm, really, there was just, in our backyard were horses. It was,
So it really was at the edge.
It was at the edge.
Yeah. What years were these?
This was, I think we moved in 54.
Okay.
To, I was going into 5th grade, so whatever that was.
Yeah.
So then Midvale School was fairly new. So I went there in 5th grade, and my class had been the first, either 3rd or 4th grade, when it opened. And I had a little bit of a hike to school. It was, well, maybe it wasn't that far now, but seemed far for walking when I was younger, because the bus only went as far as Midvale and we had to walk. So, but we had crosswalks all through Midvale Heights. And I was at Midvale in 5th and 6th grade. And then Cherokee opened as a middle school, so I went to Cherokee for 7th, 8th, and 9th. And then West High. And then I told my parents that I wanted to go to Northwestern, which I just kind of made up.
Mm-hmm. Because, Northwestern, Illinois.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And they said, ha ha, you know, there's a school down the road that you will go to. So,
because they thought it was a better school?
No, because they couldn't afford it.
Uh-huh.
And
okay,
they never even consider paying for me to go anywhere else. Okay. In fact, they said I had to live at home unless I could pay for my own way to live somewhere else, which I couldn't. So I went, started here as a freshman. And in those days, this was 62 when I started here, they let just about everybody in. Mm-hmm. If you were in the top half of the class anyway, maybe even deeper, you could get in, but they very quickly weeded you out. It was a uh-huh, pre-Vietnam and great inflation years. You got in, but if you couldn't keep up, you quickly got out.
So the attrition rate must have been,
yes,
very high.
And they always, this is, you know, kind of like um, a joke, but it really did happen, where at freshman convocation they would say, look to the left of you, look to the right, and only one of you will be here, will be graduating. And I think that was not too far off.
And did that mostly happen in the first year then, that kind of attrition?
No, usually in the second year, because you were given probation for a semester.
Okay.
So either the end of your freshman year or the first semester of your sophomore year, or even the second, is when most people flunked out.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of people did. So I signed up for ILS because the guidance counselor at West said, you know, this would be a good program for you.
Now, ILS is?
Integrated Liberal Studies.
Okay.
Which has a core curriculum for 2 years, and you can add an elective here and there, but it gives you kind of this broad liberal arts curriculum if you don't exactly know what your major is, or even if you do, and it gets you through all your required courses. So I thought, okay, well, that sounds very cool. So I signed up and got into ILS. It was a little bit of, you had to qualify, but I don't know that it took a whole lot. And so I started in that, and it was so hard.
Oh.
I mean, it had lots of kids from the East Coast. This was a big magnet school for East-West Jewish kids. And they came from prep schools, and they were so much better equipped for college than I was. I mean, West was a tough school, but they had a lot better background and you know, better thinking skills and that sort of thing. So I struggled. I didn't like it. I mean, it was interesting, but like I went to the first semester, we had classics that was taught by Professor Agard, who was this well-known, highly respected ancient guy, and he was very good. But like the first week, we're supposed to read the Iliad and the Odyssey. And that's the kind of thing that they had us doing. The homework was just unbelievable. I mean, I was just completely overwhelmed. So even though we had the best professors and probably the best students, it was too much for me. And plus, I worked part-time. So
Where did you work?
I worked at Gimbel's, which is now Macy's.
Okay, at Hilldale. Like
yeah, it went from Gimbel's to Marshall Field to Macy's. So anyway, I struggled. Although it was nice to be grounded, to be here, because our high school friends were all still here. A lot of them went here. We still got together. And I was so glad actually to get home to my own room after the stress of school.
Yeah, yeah.
And I rode in with my dad and often rode home with him, so I had easy transportation. But anyway, after a semester, I think it was just a semester, I might have been a year, I can't remember, but anyway, my grades were bad enough to be put on probation, and I said, I gotta get out of this. It's too much math. I was not a math person. I was more of a language person. So I dropped out after my freshman year. And in my freshman year, I joined a sorority, which was another big chunk of my time. So I was stretched pretty thin between working and partying and everything else that was new. So I dropped out of ILS and just went into get a BA. And I took things I liked and that I was better at, like English and poli-sci and French and whatever. And I did not, because I was on probation, I could not pledge in the sorority. I was on sorority probation too. So I didn't have that the first semester. And I got a room at Salary Hall, which was brand new,
mm-hmm.
with a high school roommate. My parents still said I had to pay for it, so I worked in the summer to pay for my room, but they paid, Salary didn't have food service. So our food was at Trip Commons at the Union. We had a hard to do that in the evening, and then during the day we could eat wherever. So my parents paid for tuition and food and books, and I paid for sorority, the dorm, and whatever else. So this time I was taking classes that were more my speed, and I ramped up my work. I really worked about part-time, about half-time. Mm-hmm. And I worked at the university club.
Oh, okay.
A friend worked there, and she talked me into it. And so at the time, the university club was a rooming house for foreign students and visiting professors or single professors. And the person who worked at the desk, which was me and my friends, we ran a switchboard, a PBX. And even then, it was very ancient technology, but it was kind of fun to learn to, you know, they didn't have dedicated phones in their rooms. They had to go through the PBX, incoming and outgoing calls.
So you would push the
levers and slots. Yep, exactly. Okay. And then in the counter, which is now pastries there, we sold cigars, cigarettes, razor blades, you know, the kind of things that men would want. And they served meals there to the residents, evening meal. I don't know if they did lunch or not. They may have. Mostly I worked on weekends. And I would have like an 8-hour shift, which was fine because I could study. You know, they weren't busy every minute. I could take my books in there. Except a lot of the guys wanted to talk to this college student at the desk. So there was just a lot of flirting that you had to get over. And there were foreign students who, you know, would want to ask you out, and, you know, you kind of had to fend them off. And there were guys who lived there who were grad students who were really cute, who would tell me about women who would climb up on the roof to get in there, climb in the windows of their rooms, because women weren't allowed upstairs.
Right.
But occasionally in the morning, I would see women coming down the stairs.
Oh, my.
So that was pretty fun. And I did end up actually dating several of the guys that I met there who eventually maybe got apartments or something. But it was a ample source of dates if necessary. And there were lots of interesting men who stayed there and interesting stories. Like there was the men from Middle East would not allow the maids in to clean their rooms. I don't exactly know the origin of that, but when they left, their rooms would just be horrible. And I think they ate in their rooms and stuff. So interesting stories about the university club. So it's ironic that I worked, that was my job for 3 years in college, and then I ended up being on the board of directors there when I took the secretary job. So one of the many ironies. So anyway, I really like living in the dorm. My grades got so much better, even working a lot. Then I pledged the sorority, and then after my sophomore year, I went and moved into the sorority house, which was fabulous fun. And I was able to actually get out of a lot of the sorority activities because I worked, and not many of the other women in the sorority house worked at all.
Uh-huh.
You know, they had parents who supported them. They had plenty of money, and I was actually glad to get out of some of the sorority chores and things by working. But also, I felt very glamorous because we had a beautiful house on Langdon, which is later sold and trashed, but that's another story. Anyway, we had this beautiful house on Langdon, and we were served meals. We had maid service. I mean, this is the best thing ever compared to, not that I was exactly Cinderella, but I had two brothers, and, you know, my mother had me do a lot of things. And so this was, I thought,
luxury.
This is the life.
Right.
And so then in my senior year, I traded off. I lived partly at home, and then I took over 8-week blocks when some of the other seniors did non-practice teaching. Mm-hmm. So that was fine. I was mostly at the house, but a few months I would go back home. But anyway, my class, my sorority class, I made some very, very good friends who I still consider my friends. Oh, I don't see them, but we keep in touch. So that was a very good experience. And the Greeks were very strong then. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I was there before the Vietnam era hit because I heard later that the officers of my sorority, which was Pi Beta Phi, walked out of the sorority in protest of the war, and our national organization shut
them down.
Chapter down and sold the house. And the local chapter, who had some investment in the house, lost it all. So that was a bleak time for sororities and Greeks in general, because it was happening quite a bit. They really, people's focus was not on Greek Week, it was on the war. So I really did leave campus before the major protests start. However, I was a political science major, and during my senior year, many of the federal agencies came to campus to recruit people. And I interviewed with the CIA and NSA and the Foreign Diplomatic Corps. Mm-hmm. I was interested in doing something political. Mm-hmm. And those interviews were something else. The tests were very hard, and then many, many pages of stuff. And then I think if you passed a test, you met with a recruiter one-on-one, and it was pretty intense. Anyway, I ended up being flown to Washington to the National Security Agency for an interview there, and they ended up hiring me. And so I was going to be off to D.C. in the fall after graduation, and a couple other people that I actually met here were going to
also
do that too.
Oh, wow.
So
also
I had
in the NSA?
Yeah, also were hired by NSA. So I had a built-in roommate when I left here to go there. So that was an interesting experience in that they sent you to, I believe it was an 8-week orientation period where they told you the different areas of the agency, and then at the end of it, they gave you a battery of tests to see what section you were most appropriate for. I was really interested, because my aptitude was in languages, to get into the Russian section, because, you know, the Cold War was really heating up or was going on, and it was interesting. And I thought, well, Vietnam is going to be a flash in the pan, but Russia's going to be going on and on. But as it turned out, they had plenty of people that knew Russian, who took Russian in college, and they could hire them with Russian already. So
had you been studying language at UW?
Yeah, I had 4 years of Latin in high school. I had 4 years of French and a year of Italian.
Okay.
And I knew some Spanish. So I was pretty grounded in languages, but not in Russian. So anyway, they told me, because you didn't have a choice, that they would send me to school for a year to learn Vietnamese, and that would be what I would be doing. So.
And this was close to like 65?
This was 67 now.
67.
Or late 66.
Okay, so things were really heating up then.
Right, right. So they really needed people to know Vietnamese so that they could transcribe intelligence coming in from the field.
Yeah.
So, but during the 8 weeks of the orientation, I met a guy who I would then marry the next spring already. But anyway, he was a computer guy, so he went to a computer section, and I went to this language school. So I was in language school for a year, learning.
And that's all you did?
All you did, all day long.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
Morning, you got up, you studied Vietnamese, you went to bed, you'd just been studying Vietnamese.
Yeah, and we were taught by a team of about three Vietnamese nationals who were probably in D.C. as either their parents or they were in the diplomatic corps, mm-hmm. but they were hired to teach us Vietnamese. And there were about a dozen of us in the class. So we actually had a pretty good time because we were together all the time. But it was, Vietnamese is a language, a monosyllabic language, but it's got five tones for each word. And it's very difficult to learn for Americans because we don't do tones.
Right, right.
So they, you know, they would have a great chuckle at our mistakes. But anyway, after we completed our training, what we all did was we sat in a room about twice this size, full of reel-to-reel tape recorders. We wore headsets, and we listened to tapes, and we typed what we heard.
So it was Vietnamese tapes, but you were typing it out in English. You were translating and typing
right.
simultaneously.
Right. And a lot of it, we were trained in northern dialect because this was the enemy speaking, and that's the pure Vietnamese. And mostly what we had, what the intelligence that was gathered, like the army guys who were collecting intelligence would be walking into the jungle with recording equipment on their backs, trying to pick up North Vietnamese people talking to, you know, Viet Cong talking to each other. So much of the tape was encoded. So it was a lot of numbers. It was very staticky. It was very hard. Yeah, very hard to hear. And you could hear bombs and you could hear them screaming American airplane. I mean, we learned the words for that. And, you know, you could tell they were yelling and then ducking, and you know, a couple of the tapes came in and they had blood on them, and
oh,
I was like, ugh.
Goodness.
But so that was stressful, and especially my brother was over there for a time. So while it was a, you know, probably a dozen of us who sat around in these tape modules. If we couldn't understand something, you know, you could ask somebody else what they heard. And if you couldn't get it, you couldn't get it. And then once we had typed it, whatever we typed went to another section for them to figure out what it all meant. They were really looking for the Vietnamese to give them quadrants of locations uh-huh. that they could pinpoint where uh-huh. the enemy was.
Right, right.
So I don't know what they got out of it, because things were so sensitive at the time that if you didn't have a need to know something, you did not know
yeah.
it. And but we all had very high security clearances, and we had to go through, you know, we had special ID tags, and we had to go through military, you know, clearances
mm-hmm.
and stuff to get in. And so it was a very interesting time. Meanwhile, there's protests outside Fort Meade where we were, and then the campus is bombed, and you know, it's a
right.
and
right.
my husband then had a deferment because he was in a critical area. But at one point when President Johnson wanted to increase the troops, he lifted all the deferments on civilians in these critical areas, and Jim immediately got a draft notice from Chicago, because that's where he was. And the Chicago district for drafting was very corrupt, and if, you know, if you didn't know someone to get you out of it, you were drafted. So He quickly looked around. He had a degree in computer science from University of Illinois, and he looked around for what his options were, and he looked at the Army, and the Army said, we've got two options for you as an officer. One is infantry and one is artillery. And Jim said, well, maybe not.
That's so almost no choice at all.
So I don't know what other, I can't remember what happened with, I don't think he could have gotten in the Air Force because his eyes were too bad. But anyway, he went to the Navy, and they told him, they really gave him a sweetheart deal. They said, you can enlist for 3 years as a E6, which is not an officer, but it's a high-ranking enlisted rank. You can come in for 3 years, do computing, and then get out. So Jim said, well, this is great. So he went off to training.
And you had had a sort of long-distance relationship anyhow, if you were in D.C. and he was in Chicago.
No, I didn't meet him until we were both at NSA.
Okay.
We got married, and then we were at NSA.
Okay.
So we were...
Oh, you weren't together at this point when he joined the Navy.
This was after we were married, while we were working.
I see. Okay.
Because we were the same age. So, yeah, he was in my class at... just out of college, he was in my class at orientation class. We met there, got married, and he went to the computer section, and I went to the Vietnam section, but in the same building.
Okay.
So he goes off to train at the Navy, and they have a very fast training class. I think it's 8 weeks or 12 weeks. It was probably 8 weeks. I don't know what they taught him in that period of time. But then he had... this kind of wish list they give you about where you want to be stationed. And one was in Scotland, and one of the options was Scotland, and one was Spain, and one was San Diego, and one was Hawaii. And so, well, these aren't, none of them were Vietnam. So I think we picked Scotland and Spain and Hawaii and San Diego as options. And lo and behold, we got Hawaii.
And so, they kept you together.
Yes. That's well, good. I was a civilian. I mean, I was just a wife.
Mm-hmm.
So he got assigned to Hawaii. I quit my job then at NSA, and we packed up and went off to Hawaii. And he worked at a very high-level bunker in Hawaii that was in a mountain or underground, where he did some tracking of, he couldn't really tell me what they did, but it seemed like it was tracking nuclear missile silos or something around the world. Mm-hmm. And I got a job. We were in an apartment on for a while waiting for some military housing to open up. And it was kind of ratty, but it was Hawaii. And I got a job at Liberty House, which was a big department store down in Waikiki. And then, and we had an apartment then in Honolulu, another kind of ratty place, but it was the time of hippies, and you didn't really mind being in a ratty place because everybody was in a ratty place. And so I had a job at this very nice department store in the clothing section, and he went off to do his computing while we waited for housing to open up. And I remember working in the department store, and people just out of their mind on LSD would come in the store, sometimes crawling in the store. And Hare Krishna would be outside the doors of the store chanting in their robes and things. And, we had mini skirts and long hair and did macrame, and it was those days. But it was Hawaii, so it was, You know, every day was gorgeous. Yeah. And so finally they offered us some housing at Pearl Harbor Base, and I went to look at it, and I said, I don't like this. It was very high-density housing, lots of little kids, and I just did not like it. And it was an Air Force base, but, well, no, actually it was Navy base housing. But anyway, I said no. So we, instead of that, we knew some people who were leaving a rental house on the North Shore. So we went up there and we rented a house on the North Shore. And that was another experience, because now we're in the midst of surfers, the big surfing community. So everybody smoked pot and went surfing. And that was kind of, and you know, we wore these wild flower bell bottoms. Right. And it was interesting time. So after a year of this house in the North Shore, which was actually kind of fun. It was a nice house, except for the couple times we had termite swarms. They offered us housing on Pearl Harbor at a place called Eva Beach, which was actually a Naval Air Force base housing, but we were able to get in, and it was really nice. These were duplexes, beautifully landscaped, palm trees, banana plants, flowers, plumeria. Mm. You know, you could make a lay for somebody coming to town outside in your yard. And so we took it, and that was beautiful. And that's where my oldest son was born when we lived there. I could stroll him. I quit my job of it. Oh, I didn't tell you about my job. I got a job at Schofield Barracks giving GED exams or college equivalency, which I think were called CLEP tests, to military personnel. And that, it was a little bit difficult to do this because they were trying to get some of the Hawaiians qualified to be in the Army.
Oh, okay.
Who really weren't very smart. Uh-huh. I mean, I can't say they weren't very smart, but there were Samoans and Filipinos and different people, which, you know, they were just like fodder, it seemed to me, to be sent.
Okay. All right.
Also, we tested prisoners, and some of them were pretty evil. But anyway, that was very interesting. And Schofield Barracks, you know, is very historic because of the book From Here to Eternity. Hmm. So anyway, I worked there, and a number of us were wives of military stationed there. So we had a great deal of fun doing that. But I quit. A whole bunch of us got pregnant at the same time and quit.
Mm-hmm.
And but I was able to put Jason in the stroller and stroll down to the beach at, you know, and let him play. And
yeah,
he got, you know, tan as a berry. And it was a great thing. But by the time he was 9 months old, Jim's tour was over. And we, he had an option to go back to NSA and resume his job.
Yeah.
But I did not want to go back there. I don't know if I should have regretted it, but it was a great place to be, but I didn't like Maryland as far as raising a family.
Yeah.
It was very corrupt then. Spiro Agnew was governor, and the corruption was really obvious compared to Wisconsin, which is like God's country as far as politics. So I insisted that we come back here, and if he could get a job here that was halfway decent, we would stay. Otherwise, our only other choice was to go back.
Yeah.
Well, we came here, stayed with my parents for a time. He did get a job.
Mm-hmm.
We bought a house, and here I was. So I stayed home with little kids for a bunch of years.
So you had another?
Yeah, had another one.
Another one.
Here. Yeah. And then I was... you know, getting kind of restless to do something. So I looked in the paper to see what kind of people, what kind of jobs were needed mm-hmm. in the marketplace, because I wasn't trained to really do anything, much to my regret. Yeah, well, I didn't want to do that anymore. Although, you know, there were refugees and immigrants coming in who were Vietnamese, but I didn't really learn that much speaking. It was mostly being able to listen and translate. And I did not want to be dragged into that, so yeah. I kind of hid from people looking for translators. Yeah. So I saw in the newspaper that what anybody was looking for mostly was people to do bookkeeping or accounting. And I'm not a numbers person, but I thought, well, I can do this. So I went to MATC to get an associate degree in accounting. And I got almost done with that when Jim and I decided to get a divorce. Mm-hmm. So that was a very traumatic time, and I could not concentrate on studying. And so it was a difficult year. And then we decided to get back together again. And since he had gotten involved with somebody in his workplace, I said, we have to leave. Mm-hmm. So he got a job in Colorado, in Denver, mm-hmm. in the Denver area, and we packed up and went to Denver. And I was reluctant to leave my parents, my friends, my support group, right. going off with this person who was not totally trustworthy at this point. But in order to save the situation, I went off to Colorado. And we bought a really nice house in a nice neighborhood, and he had a decent job, but the marriage did not. Mm-hmm. The bond had been broken, and it was just neither one of us was very happy. So I said, okay, this is over. I'm going back home.
And this is early 70s by this time.
Yes.
Is that right? So
this is late 70s now. Right.
Come along, and divorce was more common.
Yeah, I was really, when things first went bad in Madison, I was like the first of all my friends to even have to face this.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting situation in that with some who stuck by me and were supportive to others, I kind of became a pariah. So
oh, yeah.
It was an interesting split. Huh. But anyway, so this was 1980. Yeah, by now it was 1980. Okay. And I came back here, and we sold the house, and I came back and was kind of unemployed right away.
And he stayed there.
Yeah, okay. I got a duplex my mother found for me before I came back, someplace to move to. And I looked around for a job, and I ended up working for an employment agency, which was not the best job in the world, but it was a job. And after about 6 months there, I found a job through the employment agency at SICOM, which is a database support service for dental and medical offices, when they still had mainframe kind of, they sent their billing in to us and we processed somehow. And so I ended up writing for them a customer user manual. And it was an okay job. But then I bought a house. I had been renting this duplex, and I bought a house. And then I saw a job on campus at the Computing Center for Technical Writing. Oh, and I had been doing grading a technical writing course for engineering extension that I got through a friend for a couple years, which was a little extra money. Then I saw this job, and I applied, at the, it was called Madison Area Computing Center, but it was campus. And
place where your home
is. Right, exactly, exactly. And the person who interviewed me was Dave Musoff, who was my high school classmate, now secretary of the faculty. So I got, when he called and told me I got the job, I thought to myself, I am now set for life, which was true.
And meanwhile, you were raising kids.
Yes,
the whole time
right.
The kids came with you.
Right, the kids came with me, and yes, and so I had them. And although my parents were helpful, and by now they're in school, well into school. So I got the job, and I did find out, somebody told me after I'd been on the job for a couple months that their first choice had turned them down.
Oh.
So. I'm sure they weren't supposed to tell me that, but I was glad that happened because I had the job.
Yeah, serendipity can sometimes work in one's favor.
So anyway, here I am. Then I was back on campus, and I worked in various capacities at Mac and as it became DoIt. And I liked my job there a lot. I had a staff of graphic designers and writers, and it was and teachers, and it was very much fun, and I got involved in some governance stuff because of my political science background. I was interested in something that was could be controversial or where I could have a say. So I volunteered to be an alternate in the academic staff assembly, and somehow then I got appointed to what was an early iteration of the grievance committee for academic staff.
So what year is this?
So now this is 1984 when I was hired.
How was the academic staff structured at that time? There was an academic staff assembly.
There was, and I think the assembly really wasn't organized until about 85. So I probably was at work a couple years before I got interested in this. So this might not have been 86 when I first got involved in it.
And when you were the representative.
Right.
And did you represent certain folks on campus?
Yes. Now, the campus is divided into districts by job title. So for each district, and it's a job title first and then location. So I think our district was largely, well, we were all called administrative specialists then.
Okay.
This was before Hayes Hill titling. So we were divided, I believe, then more geographically. So it was the computing people, and each district had a representative and an alternate. And we had a representative, but she needed an alternate, so I agreed.
And you were covering how many folks were you representing?
Probably about 50.
Okay, all right.
I think at that time. Things have been restructured since, so I can't really recall exactly. And so when Marcia couldn't go to the assembly, then I went in her place, and that's about all you had to do is go to a meeting a month. But I must have volunteered for something because I was on this grievance panel that heard academic staff employment grievances. And then I was appointed to serve on the Hayes Hill titling exercise committee. And then from there, I think that the governance started to restructure a little bit, but I was just not privy to what was going on. I was just on committees and doing what I was told. And I was elected to the nominating committee.
So tell me about the grievance committee. What kinds of grievances do you remember coming up at that time?
I remember one in particular, and I know I probably adjudicated three or four, but one was a woman in Southeast Asian studies who was basically grieving a bad boss. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of typical of the kind of things that you would see?
Yes. I think they could grieve being laid off,
mm-hmm.
Not getting a raise.
Mm-hmm.
And in this particular case, I think this woman had stripped of some of her teaching duties and moved from a nice office to kind of a closet.
Uh-huh.
And in all of these circumstances, the academic staff member was subject to the whims or the logic of a powerful faculty member, and you know, felt pretty helpless. Mm-hmm. And in some of the cases, you know, I can only say that the academic staff member probably deserved what they got, but
uh-huh.
Some other times it was personality.
Yeah.
You know, differences, and they didn't deserve it. So,
and this was their first stop. If they had a grievance, they took it to the grievance.
Well, I think it went up a few steps first, like to the dean and to HR, and if nobody could agree, they formed this committee to hear it.
I see.
And I don't know, there were maybe five of us who heard these stories mm-hmm. and made a recommendation. And then later on, through governance, the appeals committee was formalized and structured with rules and became something very different than the early grievance
mm-hmm.
panel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also on the actual appeals committee some years later. So governance was very important in establishing ways for academic staff to officially grieve and have their situation heard,
mm-hmm.
and that still exists today. However, the recommendation of the appeals committee is still only that, a recommendation.
Uh-huh.
And the provost makes the final decision.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been cases, and important cases, where the provost overturned or
uh-huh.
the recommendation. And several of these happened kind of in a row, and the appeals committee said, one more of these and we're going to quit, because we're going to quit.
Right.
Appealing, because
right.
listening, because this is not working right.
Right.
But
do you have a sense of why they were overturned? Was it?
Well, and I mean, the very most famous case, although there were a couple others, was, we call it the UW Press case, where the press was under the auspices of the graduate school. And maybe it still is.
It still is.
Yeah. And they were bleeding money. It's not a very, you know, profitable venture, mm-hmm. yet it's supposed to be somewhat. So Virginia Henshaw, who was then the dean of the graduate school, laid off about 6-8 people,
mm-hmm.
which turned out
from the press.
Uh-huh. Who turned out to be some of the senior people. And this is not really kosher. And you know, senior people make the most money, so obviously they're looking for
right.
where to save money. But there are rules about that, and the the group appealed to the appeals committee. Now, I was on the appeals committee at that time, but I was not on the panel that heard this particular case. Uh-huh. However, I heard, you know, all the appeals committee members were reading all the papers because you might be on the panel. So the rules state, our rules, state rules, everybody's rules that, you know, they're, you have to try to retrain people. Uh-huh. You know, you can't just lay off the senior people. You can't lay off the older people. And it seemed like every kind of rule had been violated here. Because not only were these people laid off for various reasons, but LTEs were starting to be hired to basically in their place. And I, you know, it was pretty obvious that they wanted people with some different skills, with some web skills, to be doing this work instead of these old school people. But there was no attempt to train these people to do this different work. And so it was a big mess. So anyway, the appeals committee heard their stories over many days and ruled that this was improper on the part of the graduate school dean and her minions. Well, the provost, who might have been at that time John Wiley, I think. Anyway, overturned a recommendation, and I think, you know, they were wanting to save the money, and Virginia was adamant that, you know, these people needed to go. So the press...
So the decision was just overturned, and there was no attempt to do to incorporate any of the recommendations
from
the committee.
No.
They were just completely...
They were still gone, but... They took their case to the district attorney, who agreed to hear it.
Oh.
And after a long process where all these people had to testify again and subpoenas and all this, the press won.
Wow.
They those who said it was discrimination, age discrimination, and I think maybe something else, they won their case, and it cost the university money. Some of them retired, some found other jobs, but the university had to pay.
Right.
So it was a victory for the press, and it's something that remains very historical as far as the appeals committee.
So there were several overturnings, you said, kind of clumped together.
Right.
That must have had some effect on, that clearly it had an effect on the morale of the appeals committee.
Oh, yeah.
But it must have had an effect on the academic staff in general, some ripple effect.
Well, I don't know that, because a lot of the proceedings are confidential, I'm not sure that the academic staff as a whole had any clue.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the press case got publicity because it got in the major papers and things, but... it really had an effect on the appeals committee members, but there wasn't a ripple effect.
Okay.
Some of the cases are, it's very difficult to sort out who's right and who's wrong.
Right.
And, you know, and the other cases besides the press, I guess there was one other case, and I don't even remember the circumstances now, where the appeals committee really felt like... the recommendation was solid based on the evidence. And of course the provost reads the stuff, but is not present for all the evidence. But in another case, I suppose it could have gone either way. So it was quite a few, there was just maybe one too many in a short period of time, where we said if we're going through taking all these people's time and attorneys and all of this, and nobody's listening to the recommendation. Well, why should we even bother? Was getting to be our attitude. And then there were long periods without any grievances.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, we had five of them in a year, which is a big number.
Mm-hmm. So when you all got frustrated because they were being turned over, and that was communicated somehow to, the provost office?
Oh, yeah. We went and met with the provost. And the chair of the appeals committee at that time was Dennis Hill, and he was... he was a senior person at the library and very well respected and very well spoken. And, we all went to talk to the provost and had a really good conversation about what's going on here. So.
And do you feel like the provost heard,
yes,
heard it and
yeah,
took it in? And-
yeah.
Realize the seriousness of it?
Right. I think with each case where the provost disagreed with the appeals committee, to be fair to the provost, he called the panel in and explained his reasoning.
Uh-huh.
So that wasn't like he was operating in a vacuum and wasn't communicating. He was, but he wanted a little bit, more respect to the panel than to the dean that was on the other side of the case.
Right.
So I think the message was heard, and they've in most cases since then, the panel fines for the school anyway.
Uh-huh.
So there haven't been very big issues. And in cases that are marginal where... it's maybe going to be not so clear that the dean is right, most of those settle. So I would say in the vast majority of cases in the last 10 years, the panel has found for the campus.
Do you attribute that to the rules and the processes being better defined and the ethics being better defined, or to what do you attribute?
Well, the rules are better defined for one thing, and they're constantly being tweaked.
Mm-hmm.
The appeals committee is kind of under, in a very loose way, the Personnel Policies and Procedures Committee. And if there are some things that the appeals committee thinks need better definitions in ASPP, they will take that to the PPPC and ask them to modify the document to make it clearer. So things have been tweaked over the years to make the wording more clear.
Yeah, yeah.
The rights of academic staff are more clearly defined.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the rights on both sides have become clearer. And some of the things that people grieve, even though we have good procedures, there are instances where the burden has to be on the employee to prove their case, and they just can't prove it. Often it's sort of personality clashes, and there's a problem employee, and there's a person that's grieving.
Right.
So,
right.
It happens both ways. But I think the appeals committee takes their work extremely seriously. They take a lot of their time and energy reviewing the case, hearing the case, and writing up a recommendation, and they do a super job.
So I want to talk also about the Hayes Hill. And I just want to, it's 10 after 2.
Okay.
Do you want to start this conversation? Because from my understanding of the academic staff history, that was kind of a key piece.
It was, but I don't know enough about it to talk very long.
Okay. So tell me what you do know about
it. They decided that having this one big category for academic staff called administrative specialists was not really adequate in defining what we did. And also, the state wanted to know what people were doing in case maybe they should be not academic staff, but classified staff.
Okay.
So they brought in this group called Hayes Hill to...
Now, what is Hayes Hill's?
Some names that, of a consulting firm, I believe,
okay.
Who came in to look at all the jobs, what people were doing, and then once they could see what people's jobs were, they could identify titles and assign us titles based on not only what we did, but what our salaries were.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a... actually, I don't know that I had much to do with Hayes Hill. I'm thinking what my job was a different committee, was a gender equity committee.
Oh.
Because Hayes Hill was done by these consultants, and I don't think we had a whole lot of input. I was on a different group which did a gender equity salary study.
So Hayes Hill was about what years? Do you remember?
I think Hayes Hill was in the early 90s.
Okay. All right. So but, this is...
But I'm not very good with dates. So this went on for many years. So maybe it started in the late 80s. I can't remember. And it was a big deal. We all had to write out what we did, and then we were given titles and we were given salaries. So it went from everybody being called an administrative specialist to people called information processing people, and I was an editor and lecturers and instructors and
mm-hmm.
student services people and advisors, and mm-hmm. we got hundreds of titles. It's so confusing that still today they
still
can't
today.
Figure it all out. But based on your duties and your length of service and the salary that you came into, you were slotted into whether you were an associate, a no prefix, or a senior, with all these titles adding to the complications. And I believe that I was made at that point an editor, a no prefix editor. And some people, and I resent this to this day, because they were making so much money, they were given the distinguished title, which now you have to jump through many hoops to get.
Right.
But because they had ranges for different titles, people who were outside of the normal ranges were given a distinguished title just because of their salary range. And I think that was patently unfair, but that's how it was. So anyway, now that you had this title structure in place, you could aspire to
prefixes.
And that also had a governance played a big part in that,
mm-hmm.
in having your title reviews at regular intervals.
It was the academic staff governance that would do the title reviews for individuals?
No, but they made it more or less mandatory for supervisors to give reviews.
Uh-huh.
And to this day, they send out letters every year telling academic staff that they can ask for a review.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all based on having this title structure so that you could move up. However, if you were slotted into a title such as editor, you could be an editor for 5 years. I don't know. I think 3 years you could get ask for a title change, or five. I can't remember what it is. And then you could, if they saw that your duties, and each different title had a set of duties with it. if your duties were not reflected in the senior thing, then they could deny your,
mm-hmm.
or you could, maybe if you were given more duties early, you could get a promotion mm-hmm. early. And they could do base adjustments as well to give you some more money. But anyway, you pretty much got slotted into a title, which was very difficult to get out of.
Yeah.
So personally for me, I was an editor, and then I was a senior editor, and now what? Because editor is kind of not a very good title. I mean, it's a low-level title. So even a senior isn't making all that much money, and then where are you going to go? I mean, distinguished is just not easy. So I was lucky at DeWitt that because my job as an editor really morphed into computer work, I got a title change to a information processing consultant, which was in a higher range.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was lucky to be in a large organization that allowed me to jump mm-hmm. titles mm-hmm. based on different duties. In many places on campus, if you were an advisor, you were always going to be an advisor uh-huh. because you didn't do anything else.
Right.
And you would hit a ceiling.
Right.
So the titling was good in some respects because it did describe what we did. We did feel like we were something. On the other hand, it could limit where you went.
Right.
And as you may know, on this campus, there is not a career progression that's very easy to get into unless you can convince somebody that you can do a whole different thing mm-hmm. than you've been doing.
Yeah, jumping titles is difficult.
It is. It also allowed for Hayes Hill to, I mean, looking at the titles, to move a whole lot of people into the classified staff.
Oh, it did.
Mm-hmm. And okay. I don't think that was wrong. I mean, there are people here who are doing similar work to what they're doing in a state agency. Some of them are doing work that strictly has an academic part to it, but other people aren't. So I didn't think that was terribly unfair, and certainly in the computing area, people in the classified staff make a lot more money than the academics doing computing.
Huh.
I don't know, the state ranges for computing are just go higher.
Oh, and is that still the case today?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
But what they do at DeWitt and other places is they do this thing called extraordinary ranges where they can, if there's market data that says that they're not competing, they can give them extra money.
Oh, okay.
So people at DeWitt make way too much money in my view. And that's for the record, because I have stated it before. I used to work there, and, you know, had I not left there and gone into administration, I would have been making more money,
yeah.
clearly.
Yeah.
But it's not all about the money.
Yeah, right.
So you want to leave it there?
It's 2:20, and, yeah.
Okay, I mean, we could, if there's another topic you want to morph to, but...
I think let's stop here.
Okay.